Hello, everyone. Welcome to the 11th episode of the series of podcasts with IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Mohammad Mustafa Hussein, the professor of electrical engineering and computer science of University of California, Berkeley. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest today is someone whose pioneering work on solar cell is used today in 90% of the solar cell production in the world. He has been awarded IEEE Cherry Award in 1990, IEEE Ebers Award in 1995, and Japan Prize in 2021. His nomination for the Royal Society of Fellow in 2013 reads, Professor Martin Green is cited for his extensive and distinguished contributions to photovoltaic science and technology. These include identifying the fundamental limits upon silicon solar cell performance and then leading his team to demonstrate experimental devices approaching this limit with 25% cell efficiency now demonstrated. This is over 50% relatively higher in performance than at the beginning of his work. He has also developed innovative commercial versions of these high-performance devices and pioneered the field of third-generation photovoltaics, investigating advanced photovoltaic device concepts targeting Carnot-like solar conversion efficiencies. In 2018, he became the celebrated member of IEEE Electron Devices Society. How are you doing today?
Yes, it's a lovely day here in Sydney, so it's looking like it's a pleasant day ahead. It's also my wife's birthday, so a very special day.
Happy birthday to her. And so we'll go and start from the very beginning. If you can kindly share with us about your childhood, any fond memories, anything that you regret, those are the stuff that, that we would like to know.
Yes, well, I was born in Brisbane, which is getting towards the northern bits of Australia, so sort of subtropical type of climate there. But, I remember very fondly my school days, plenty of good friends. And, particularly the lunch hours where we used to all play together. I remember used to play a bit of football. We play rugby league. Well, in Queensland, rugby league is the most popular game. So I used to play football since I was quite young. And that was, we had a very good coach, so we did well. So that was exciting to be in a team that won more often than they lost. A very happy childhood. So Brisbane does not have beaches like Sydney does, but in about an hour's drive in either direction, you can get to the surf beaches, which are very popular in Australia. So every holidays we'd spend camping at the beaches either to the north or the south of Brisbane. And that's very happy childhood memories from there as well.
Great. I have been a huge fan of Australian cricket, we have followed this, and that's why Australia, many of the locations are like, the cricketing grounds, those are very familiar to us, although through the televisions. But then the first time I visited Australia, that was in 2018, I didn't go to Brisbane, but I was in Sydney, University of New South Wales, definitely. It was, fantastic country, beautiful. There is no doubt about that. And it's great to hear that, you grew up with so many fond memories. We'll fast forward a little bit. And how was your college life?
Yeah, so I did my high school, and I did quite well in Australia, each of the states of Australia. You know, there's six states, if I remember right, has their own sort of matriculation exam for university entrance. So everyone in the state sits the same exam. So I did very well in that. So I got what was called an open scholarship to Queensland University that allow you to do any course you wanted to, you know, with free tuition and all that kind of thing, and a bit of a stipend as well, if I remember right. You know, in my high school, I was very interested in physics, and we had a very good physics teacher, and he had an oscilloscope. So we did a lot of sort of electrical engineering type experiments, watching curves on oscilloscopes and things like that as part of our physics course. So I got interested in electrical engineering. So I decided to do that at Queensland University. And so a four-year undergraduate degree in electrical engineering. And then Australia is part of the British Commonwealth of Nations, which was probably a more important collaboration back in the 60s than it is now. But there was a Commonwealth scholarships offered that allowed students to move between the different members of the Commonwealth to study. So I was able to pick up a scholarship to study in Canada. So I did my PhD at McMaster University in Canada, and I was already a little bit interested in solar cells, but my thesis at McMaster University was got me more involved in solar cell and working on approaches and so on that proved quite productive in terms of improving solar cell performance. So in a nutshell, I guess that's my my college career. In the meanwhile, I managed to get married, so my wife came over to Canada with me, so we had a very happy time there with very low stipend, but when you look back on those days, even though there wasn't much money coming in and you counted every penny you spent, a very, very good time of our lives.
Yeah, you actually proved the theory, like, you know, that sometimes happiness has nearly very small correlation with how much money you have. Sometimes you can be very happy and satisfied even with the what you have, as long as you're spending them wisely. Okay, so because we got to solar cell, but before that, I'd like to ask you this question that when you think about, like, you know, you came across the oscilloscope, you played with that, more electrical engineering type experiments and so on and so forth. But, you know, you had so many different choices. There are many other engineering and you could have, like, you know, taken any of those routes. But what really made you passionate about the overall, the electronics, you know, the per se, the solar cell?
Yeah, it's, I guess when I was finishing my undergraduate degree, you know, microelectronics was just taking off, and that was a very exciting area. And, you know, the semiconductor physics courses were quite difficult, so I had to sort of work hard to understand what was going on in the semiconductor physics courses. So that also made it more interesting because, you know, a lot of the courses you could just sort of coast through without having to do any extra study or anything. But with the semiconductor physics, I really had to work hard to get a hold on the underlying concepts and everything. So that made it quite interesting. And, you know, with microelectronics, I've just started to put multiple transistors onto chips and things like that. So that became a bit of a interest and passion. And, you know, I did my undergraduate thesis on simulating semiconductor devices. So some of the early programs, it wasn't the first one, but it was in the first half dozen of programs that simulated the electronic properties of, in my case, diodes and bipolar transistors by solving the fundamental differential equations. So, you know, computers were just getting powerful enough to be able to do a good job of that, you know, back when I was graduating. So my undergraduate thesis and went on to a master's thesis was looking at, solving the semiconductor equations. And, you know, what I particularly got interested in was just seeing where the theory, where the complete analysis differed from the basic theory that you do in the textbooks. So that gave me a very good understanding of both the basic theory in the textbooks as well as where real life departed from that basic theory. So, you know, that was very important, I think, in just early in my career, I was able to build up that fundamental understanding of semiconductor devices that has stood me in good stead since then.
Very well. So, you know, that the understanding the fundamental semiconductor physics, that's not an intriguing, can actually be difficult, but whenever you are you deep dive into it, it's actually like, you know, the it's so I would say so fascinating, right? Like, you know, that it has always been a balancing act in the semiconductor physics, and then to transform that into a device through the choice of materials, the processes, and then improving it. This has been the trend for the last 50 years, but I think like, and it's going to be like this for, I would say that at the least 50 more years or so, there will be no stopping for the innovation in electronics. So from those perspectives, tell us about your first job, how you got into it, and how did you like it? Like, you know, what was your experience?
Yeah, so I guess when I was going through high school and university, I used to do part-time work over the holiday break and things like that. But, just sort of manual type labor type jobs. But my first real job as an engineer was at a local microelectronics company. Well, actually not local to Brisbane where I was living then, but a Sydney microelectronics company. And they were making integrated circuits with, maybe 10 transistors was a pretty complicated circuit, and the masks were all cut by hand and all that kind of thing. So it was very early days, but, I had some projects there, like using diodes to work out the temperature distribution over the chip, and that kind of thing was the project they gave me. But it was more like a vacation job. So I was only there for a couple of months, but that was my first real job. And ever since then, I've really been in academia, so that even though I've been involved with a number of commercial operations and actually set a few up myself, I haven't really worked for a commercial organization apart from a university since then. I'm a consulting work and everything, I guess, would violate that general assumption. But so my whole career since then has been academically based, although had strong commercial connections and, you know, been quite successful in getting some of the technology that I have developed during my research out into production.
Right, like, you know, you have driven the industry, right? Like, you know, that the industry has, that they have followed your lead regarding the solar cell. I'm in California. When I look around, the many of the houses, they actually have the solar cells. Those are silicon based. That's where, we get a lot of our. And the power is coming from there. This is quite normal. I used to live in Austin, Texas, and people call that Texas is a politically red state, more conservative, but it actually had one of the highest per capita solar cells, many of the cities in the United States. So there has always been this boom. And lately I got involved back in 2016-17. Since then, Lockheed Martin has supported our work to have flexible crystalline silicon solar cells and stretchable ones. I am personally that indebted to your work, what you have done. I will now focus our conversation mostly on your major innovation, okay, on the solar cells. And from there, did you have any eureka moment that, yes, this is the way that if I actually move forward, then I will be having that the highest efficiency in the silicon solar cell, which is going to have a robust and sustainable, the continuation and impact for the rest of the world?
Yes, my PhD thesis was on tunneling contacts, metal insulator semiconductor contacts where the insulator got very narrow and you got tunneling currents through there, just looking at what type of devices you might be able to make from a MOS type structure when you had large tunnel currents. And energy conversion was one of them. So my supervisor had a beta voltaic project underway where you use electrons to do what photons do in a normal solar cell. And these MIS structures, outperformed all the conventional PN junction diodes that we could make in terms of their beta voltaic conversion efficiency. So very simple to measure. You just stick them under the same beta voltaic source and you just see how much power you're getting out. The challenge was, using a metal as on the top as part of the junction, if you like, of the device was getting the light through that. So it worked better for beta voltaics than photovoltaics. But I think, one of the biggest eureka moments I had was just realizing if you made a structure that was a MIS structure on one side of the wafer and an MIS structure on the other side, you could make this, nearly perfect solar cell in that you'd get both surfaces well passivated by these tunneling structures, as well as all the field directions and everything driving the carriers towards the junction where they're collected. So that it just seemed to me to be the perfect structure. And in the commercial field now, there's a heterojunction solar cell, a HIT solar cell, or HJT solar cell that uses the same type of concept. But I think that, I really had a eureka moment when what we call MISIM solar cell. I said, oh, well, that's got to be the perfect solar cell structure. But I guess that was the first big one. And then we set our first world record for solar cell performance. And we're very lucky. I think a lot of our success is due to the fact that the performance of a solar cell is quantifiable. you can send them off to a recognized test center that's an expert expert at doing measurements. So you get a number back from them that no one can argue with. So I think that was very important to our success in that we got our first world record in 1983. Which was the first 18% efficient silicon solar cell, that no one could contest it. And it clearly established that we were doing better than anyone else in the world, because anyone else that was doing better could easily send their cells along and have their performance measured under the same basis. So that was very important, particularly in terms of getting funding and so on, because it was indisputable that we were doing well. But we looked at ways of, when we got that 18% efficient solar, making it more practical. So we came up with this buried contact solar cell. We were early to apply lasers to solar cell processing. So they're used quite routinely now, but we were probably the first to apply them to a conventional silicon cell at least. But we came up with this buried contact solar cell that required laser processing, and it allowed us, for our record cells, we were using photolithography, which is a little bit too expensive to use for solar cells. So we came up with this laser processing that did the same job. And that was our first commercial success, was the buried contact solar cell, which our biggest licensee was BP Solar. And they marketed product based on that from 1992 to 2006. And it was, at one stage, the most efficient solar panels by far that you could buy were these BP solar panels based on our buried contact cell technology. So when we came up with the buried contact approach and saw how well it worked, that was another eureka moment. We said, well, this is really very simple processing, but it does everything you can do with beta lithography without the costs.
Right, like, you know, the most often and the most important and powerful innovations, which brings like, you know, the economical change and our, like, you know, the way we lead our life, they are simple but elegant solutions. I think, like, you know, that's the essence of engineering. A simplification of the complex engineering is the way to go. So when you worked on this, I think, like, you know, the can you please share some like, you know, the some of your memories with your team, how they actually worked under your leadership, and spend their time, and, like, you know, the, you know, that in these kind of things, like, you know, the today is the day, oh, it looks so bright, and on the following day, oh, we have to do again this measurement, and, like, you know, the all those kind of things.
Yeah. So we started off with quite a small team, but we were very efficient when we had about six team members, and everyone had a well-defined job, and everyone saw each other every day and spoke to each other every day. So there was good interchange of information and that kind of thing. So, you know, so that's the team that got us to the 18% efficiency. So, you know, one member of the team was looking after the anti-reflection coatings and the plating, and someone else was in charge of the processing of the wafers into cells, and someone else was doing the metallization contacts, but they all became very good at what they were doing, but plenty of interchange with the people doing the steps before them and so on. My main job was measuring the cells, because I was doing a lot of lecturing at the time, so you didn't get many long hours that you could do processing or anything like that. So whereas measuring the cells, you could do, you know, just about any time, and it was only an hour or two involved in measuring a whole group of them. So that was my main contribution to the effort, as well as, you know, leading the team and, you know, regular meetings to see where we were and where we should be going. So I guess after that, I tried to organize our activities around small groups of about six people, you know, just because it seemed to work so well when we only had six. But as we grew, trying to keep people in teams of six just seemed like a good strategy, and tried to follow that through in what we did after that. But yeah, there's all the team members got on well together, and it's very exciting when you are setting world records. You know, so we didn't set one every day, but, you know, they may be 6 months or a year apart, but that was a cause for a big celebration in the laboratory every time. So a bottle of champagne would be cracked open, and everyone would join in the celebration once we knew we'd really nailed a jump over what we'd done earlier.
Right, right. Yeah, I think, like, you know, this is exactly the things we are, you know, our audience is going to get from here, like, you know, a team of six people, like, you know, when you form the teams, right? Like, you know, those are the up close information that we get whenever we are talking to our the luminaries like yourself. Professor Martin Green is Sinetia Professor at the University of New South Wales, Sydney, and Director of the Australian Centre for Advanced Photovoltaics, involving several other Australian universities and research groups. His group's contributions to photovoltaics are well known and include holding the record for silicon cell efficiency for 30 of the last 37 years, described as one of the top 10 milestones in the history of solar photovoltaics. The PERC, or Park solar cell, that he invented in 1983 and his team developed to its full potential, accounted for an estimated 85% of worldwide solar module production in 2020. Major international awards include the 1999 Australia Prize, the 2002 Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, the 2007 Solar World Einstein Award, the 2016 Young Work Medal from the Australian Academy of Science, and the prestigious Global Energy Prize in 2018. Okay, so I will actually switch to a rather lighthearted, like, you know, the question the moment where we'll be asking you some interesting questions, and our younger audience, they're very much interested about those. And then we will go to the final part, which is more about your vision about the future. Okay. So this we call the rapid fire round, and try to be concise, like, you know, that, but you know that I cannot restrict you. You can pick as many as words possible, like, and if you want, but so I'll go from here. Okay. All right. Okay. So my first question in that regard, what are your hobbies?
Well, I live very close to the beach in Sydney. So beach activities, swimming, running, that kind of thing. And also enjoy traveling.
Okay. Music or movie, which one you enjoy more?
I guess I didn't quite catch the question, so would you mind repeating it?
Oh, okay. So music or movie, which one you enjoy more?
Probably movies. I'd say movies.
Okay. And what is your favorite genre of movie? What kind of movie you like?
I like light-hearted, uplifting ones. So, you know, my favorite is probably Groundhog Day with Bill Murray and Andy McDowell. But that was really funny, and had some messages in it that I thought were quite uplifting.
Right. You know that, you know, our Hollywood is actually enriched by many stars. And they hailed from Australia. So there is another contribution of Australia in our movie world. What is the book you are reading now?
Oh, it's a little bit heavy, but it's History of the English-Speaking People by Winston Churchill. So he was a very good writer. I like his turn of phrase, but he actually won the Nobel Prize for Literature in the 1950s. So he was really a very good writer and very experienced international observer and so on. So I'm quite enjoying that.
Right, like, you know, that this is a very interesting piece of information for the larger audience, because we know Winston Churchill, who headed as the Prime Minister of Great Britain, like, you know, in England, that during the tough time of World War II, but he was also a very good writer, right? Like, you know, that people say that, like, you know, that he was a little bit hard in his conversation. But he was an interesting character. History will, like, you know, evaluate that way. What is your favorite cuisine?
Oh, in Australia, Asian food is very popular, and Asian fusion, which is sort of a blend of Asian and Western cuisines. So, so last night we went to a Vietnamese restaurant, and the food was just really delicious. So taking advantage of, you know, the pillow impression, you know, the last thing your head rested on leaves the indent in the pillow. But, Vietnamese food is my favorite at the moment.
Very good. So you enjoy beach activities. Any specific sports you enjoy? You played rugby.
Too old to play rugby now, but so I'm still able to run, so that's a good sport I enjoy. And my wife and I have done a lot of cycling trips, so you do a lot of cycling, and then you one I remember in particular was cycling in Spain, the El Camino in Spain, and you'd cycle hard each day, 100 kilometers or more, but each night you'd stay at a parador, which is a medieval sort of building that which was very luxurious, so you'd be rewarded for your efforts. So that's a hobby that I really enjoyed, combining traveling and exercise.
Right. Anyway, Spain is very unique. Every time I have been there, like, and I find the serendipity, you know, the overseeing the Mediterranean Sea, and like, you know, the orange orchard behind you, it's just like, you know, they're amazing. So what is your favorite travel spot?
Well, the Mediterranean in Europe, I always enjoy going there. You know, so I guess the thing about being involved in solar is it gives you the opportunity to travel to many places, because there's hardly anywhere in the world that's not interested in solar and what's been happening in that field. So we've been to many countries, but Mediterranean's always nice. I spend a lot of time in China over recent years, so that is an interesting country to visit as well. And other parts of Southeast Asia, like Vietnam and Thailand, and also done a fair bit of travel in those countries as well.
Okay. Hey, so we are coming back to Solar Cell and your vision about the future. So my first question regarding that is, what is your thought about the future of solar cells? We know it's bright, but the question is that, do you see beyond the brightness?
Yeah, so, you know, when you look at it realistically, like, it's one of the few options that we really do have for addressing climate change. So if you're talking about generating large amounts of energy cheaply, you know, solar is now the cheapest way of doing that. So I think it's got to play a major role in our tradition and our transition from fossil fuels to something more sustainable. So I think that view is becoming more prevalent very rapidly. You know, like 5 years ago, it would have been an extreme view, but now I think it's a view that is getting more and more generally accepted. You know, I honestly believe that, you know, over the next 30 years, we'll see solar move from a small part of our energy system that it is at present to being the major part. So I can see the world sort of solar powered by 2050, that type of timescale. So we're talking about huge amounts of solar, like 100 times more than what we have installed at the moment. So a massive upscaling of the amount installed. But there's been studies done that show that, you know, solar combined with wind, which is quite complementary in its generation characteristics, and storage such as batteries and things like pumped hydro and hydrogen, it is technically feasible. So, and I think we'll head there sort of increasingly rapidly. The thing about solar and photovoltaics is that it's exceeded every prediction and expectation. So things have happened more quickly than what anyone has ever forecast. I'm a bit of an optimistic, so I tend to make optimistic forecasts, but solar has exceeded my most optimistic forecasts about where it is at the moment compared to where I thought it would be. So I'm hoping that continues, because it's quite important that we do find an alternative to fossil fuels, and solar has arrived at a point in time where it probably can help restrict the changes that are going to be caused by the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Right. I personally have no doubt, like, the solar cell is going to be the major source of power going forward. And I hope that it's going to be sooner than 2050, because especially when I look at my daughters, they're 12 and 14, the way that they see the world, that's quite different. So the next generation is definitely gung-ho about, like, you know, the renewable energy, and there is nothing that can match the efficiency, the cleanliness, as well as the abundance, like the solar cell. There is no doubt about the sunlight and, like, you know, that kind of the energy. And my question, a little bit technical, that there are some other materials, those are being explored, some of them have been used, like, you know, the 3-5, for, like, on the space type activities, and obviously there are, like, you know, organic, you know, the those kind of, like, in the Parvus kit. Do you see that it's going to be all of the above, the kind of materials those will push the technology, or do you think that the silicon will lead the way?
Yeah, I think silicon definitely has a very big future. But I see the next logical step is to go to a tandem stack cell where you stack cells from different materials or at least of different band gaps on top of one another to improve the conversion efficiency. So the having different band gaps mean you can have cells that are specialized at a smaller band range of light, and you can improve the efficiency that way. But the challenge has been finding something that has all the attributes of silicon. So it's cheap, it's abundant, it's non-toxic, it's stable, and it gives high efficiency. So finding other materials that have those properties is the real challenge. So we're working on alternatives, like my group I'm involved with holds the world record for another compound, CZTS, copper, zinc, tin sulfide, but which has all the attributes of silicon, or it's not quite as good, but it's relatively benign and so on, and abundant materials and so on used. But we're only at 11% efficiency with it, even though it's a world record. So we need to get that to 20% before we could combine that with silicon to improve silicon's efficiency. So, I see that the biggest challenge facing photovoltaic at the moment, the biggest research challenge, is to find a material that you could use in conjunction with silicon to make these stack cell structures. So a lot of interest in perovskites at the moment, but the compound involved is 30% lead, which is not great when you think about the quantities of photovoltaics that you're going to have to deploy to fulfill the role that we both talked about of providing the major source of energy for the world. So ideally you wouldn't have toxic materials like lead involved, and also stability has been a big issue with that compound, so that I see there's four attributes you have to have, abundance, non-toxicity, stability, and high efficiency. And the perovskites tick two of those boxes, but the other two you get across. And then with the CZTS, you tick three boxes, but the efficiency you get across. So interestingly, organic solar cells recently shown a big boost in performance. So, the record now is over 18% efficiency. If you can get it up over 20% in large areas, it might be a feasible candidate for stacking onto silicon. So, maybe a question mark about stability, but it, that might be a direction things go, or else, these compounds involving multiple elements, and I think you're probably going to need at least four, because the space involving only three elements combined to give a silicon-like compound has been explored pretty thoroughly. A four element compound that can reproduce the properties and attributes of silicon but with a higher band gap is what we desperately need at the moment.
Yeah, that this part of this conversation is going to be the lighthouse for anybody who is working on the solar cell. So many important directions that you made from the perspective of the choosing the right material, pushing the efficiency, working on the stability factor. And one of the things you pointed out, and I'm so happy for that, because as someone I give talk and I say that if we use lead, in lead selenium or there, and then we say that this is green, I think that's a complete disaster. So you brought up that point also. Yeah. So my next question is there anything that strikes your mind which can be better today? It can be technical, it can be non-technical, it doesn't matter.
So I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Is there anything that you see that is happening today in the world that can be technical or non-technical, you think that could have been better?
Yes, I think so. In Australia, our political masters have a different concept of the future from many Australians, but they are quite keen to see Australia's leadership in coal continue indefinitely into the future. So, Australia Probably has one of the highest percentages of electricity generated by coal, as well as exporting, more coal than just about anyone else. Obviously a big part of our industry, although very small in percentage terms, I guess, of our GDP. But, I think a more positive attitude in the political arena towards the challenges that we should be facing urgently in addressing climate change would be a big, big improvement.
Right. Right, Leon, this is kind of like, our existential challenge going forward. And people are adopting. And I think that we also have a new administration and the new president, Joe Biden, he is actually appreciative to the fact of the climate change. He's working on, I think that the overall aspect is the more politically challenging, but the more and more the future generation, they actually vote, that will actually elect the leadership that will be working toward to solve the the climate crisis. Okay, it can be anything related to solar cell energy harvesting, energy related, but it can be non-energy related also. Okay. Is there any specific electronic application or any other kind of technological innovation that you would like to see in future, but that does not exist today?
Yeah, well, I guess, improved batteries. So if you could develop batteries that weren't dependent on lithium, for example, that might be a good move. I know many people are working on sodium-based batteries, which would remove a resource constraint on, indefinite, infinite sort of adoption levels. Getting hydrogen production down to a very inexpensive level, I think is very important. So new catalysts and so on for hydrogen production that can really take the costs out of that. So I think the electricity is going to be very cheap. So I think you can do hydrogen cheaply, maybe even without those. But if you can get away from expensive catalysts to inexpensive ones, I think that would be a big step forward.
Very good. What is your one piece of advice for the younger generation?
Well, career-wise, I guess, I've really enjoyed my career, but I've been fortunate enough to be able to get involved with work that I'm really interested in. So I think that would be my career advice. Try and direct your career so that you're doing work that you're really interested in and you find really rewarding.
Okay, so that was my last question, which is scripted. But I'm going to ask you the one final question that I have asked everyone. Was there any, or is there anything that, I did not ask you, but you wanted to share with us?
I guess we didn't talk too much about our PERC cell technology, PERC, that's how it's spelled. But over the last 5 years, it's suddenly moved from nowhere to become the solar cell technology that's produced in the highest volume worldwide. I think last year, over 90% of the solar cells made were made with PERC cell technology. I'm particularly proud of that because I actually invented the PERC cell structure back in 1983. But the interesting thing with the solar industry growing so quickly, even though PERC has only been around commercially for 5 years or so, by the end of this year or early next year, so that's the end of 2021, early 2022, more PERC solar cells would have been sold and installed commercially than any other solar cell technology in the history of the human race. So I'm really... I find that really quite satisfying when you think back on it and think about the years of our research and development that went into developing the technology to its full potential, and now to see it now having such a huge success commercially and helping to drive down the costs through the improved efficiency that you get from the structure and also the improved functionality, like now bifacial modules that respond to light from both directions can be made very inexpensively. And the PERC is particularly suited for large area wafers because it's easy to chop them up into smaller cells. So we're seeing a big increase in the wafer size used in solar cell activity since the introduction of PERC. So now solar cell manufacturers are using the biggest square wafers that you can cut from a 300 millimeter a wafer size, which is, you know, what the microelectronics industry has been using for some time. So we're, you know, we wish the microelectronics industry had already got to 450 although millimeters, although I hear now that that's unlikely to happen before 2029. But you know, the solar cell industry may, you know, traditionally has used smaller wafers and ingots than in microelectronics, but perhaps with this recent opening up of opportunities for larger wafers that PERC has introduced, we'll see the solar industry go to bigger and bigger ingots and get ahead of microelectronics in pushing towards the 450 and 675 sort of nodes a little bit earlier than microelectronics.
Right. Yeah, I think, like, you know, that's where, like, you know, it has the real potential, because kind of the semiconductor industry, you know, I joined academia from semiconductor industries, and we abandoned the idea of 450 millimeter because if there is an error, then it's actually a lot of wastage of the silicon area. But compared to, like, you know, the solar cell has a relatively, like, you know, the more like thin film deposition based, like, you know, the processes. So it actually, as long as we can maintain the process uniformity, we can do it with the right element and can, like, you know, the keep the cost really in the low end, we should be fine. And I think, like, you know, the bigger is going to be the better in this case. Okay, Martin. So thank you so much for your time. And it was really enlightening for me. And I'm sure that when our audience is going to listen to this episode of the podcast, they are going to like it very much. You know, you have been extremely resourceful and very helpful, being very accommodating. But like, you know, the pretty much, like, you know, the a lot of the insightful suggestions and advices that you shared, they are going to be, again, I would use the word, like, you know, it's going to be a lighthouse for many, many researchers, like, you know, who are working on solar cell as well as any kind of energy harvesting technology.
Thank you, Mohammed. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS-sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.